Chapter 21. She paused for his reply, and as it did not come she continued, colon if Adelaide Painters, to be told there's no possible reason why I shouldn't tell Mr. Darrow. Owen abruptly set down the little statuette between his fingers. One whatever. I want everyone to know. She smiled a little at his overemphasis, and was about to meet it with a word of banter when he continued, facing her. You haven't, as yet, said a word to him? I've told him nothing, except what the discussion of our own plans, his and mine, obliged me to. That you were thinking of marrying, and that I wasn't willing to leave France till I'd done what I could to see you through. At her first words the color had rushed to his forehead. But as she continued she saw his face compose itself and his blood subside. You're a brick, my dear, he exclaimed. You had my word, you know. Yes, yes I know. His face had clouded again. Indeed that's all positively all you've ever said to him? Positively all. But why do you ask? He had a moment's embarrassed hesitation. T was understood, wasn't it, that my grandmother was to be the first to know? Well and so as he has been, hasn't she, since you've told her? He turned back to his restless shifting of the knick-knacks. And you're sure that nothing you've said to Darrow could possibly have given him a hint, nothing I've said to him certainly. He swung about on her. Why do you put it in that way? In what way? Why as if you thought someone else might have spoken. Dot, someone else? Who else? She rose to her feet. Hat on earth, my dear boy, can you be driving at? I'm trying to find out whether you think he knows anything definite. Why should I think so? Do you? I don't know. I want to find out. She laughed at his obstinate insistence. Oh, test my veracity, I suppose? At the sound of a step in the gallery she added, colon, here he is, you can ask him yourself. She met Darrow's knock with an invitation to enter, and he came into the room, and paused between herself and Owen. She was struck, as he stood there, by the contrast between his happy careless good looks and her stepson's frowning agitation. Darrow met her eyes with a smile. Am I too soon? Or is our walk given up? No, I was just going to get ready. She continued to linger between the two, looking slowly from one to the other. But there's something we want to tell you first. Owen is engaged to Miss Viner. The sense of an indefinable interrogation in Owen's mind made her, as she spoke, fix her eyes steadily on Darrow. He had paused just opposite the window, so that, even in the rainy afternoon light, his face was clearly open to her scrutiny. For a second, immense surprise was alone visible on it. So visible that she half turned to her stepson, with a faint smile for his refuted suspicions. Why, she wondered, should Owen have thought that Darrow had already guessed his secret, and what, after all, could be so disturbing to him in this not improbable contingency? At any rate, his doubt must have been dispelled. There was nothing feigned about Darrow's astonishment. When her eyes turned back to him, he was already crossing to Owen with outstretched hand, and as he had, through an unaccountable faint flutter of misgiving, a mere confused sense of their exchanging the customary phrases. Her next perception was of Owen's tranquilized look, and of his smiling return of Darrow's congratulatory grasp. As he had the eerie feeling of having been overswept by a shadow which there had been no cloud to cast. A moment later Owen had left the room, and she and Darrow were alone. He had turned away to the window, and stood staring out into the downpour. You're surprised at Owen's news? She asked. Yes. I am surprised, he answered. You hadn't thought of its being Miss Viner? Why should I have thought of Miss Viner? You see now why I wanted so much to find out what you knew about her. He made no comment, and she pursued, colon, now that you do know it's she, if there's anything, he moved back into the room, and went up to her. His face was serious, with a slight shade of annoyance. What on earth should there be? As I told you, I've never in my life heard anyone say two words about Miss Viner. Anna made no answer, and they continued to face each other without moving. For the moment as he had ceased to think about Sophie Viner and Owen. The only thought in her mind was that Daryl was alone with her, close to her, and that, for the first time, their hands and lips had not met. He glanced back doubtfully at the window. Tea's pouring. Perhaps you'd rather not go out? She hesitated, as if waiting for him to urge her. Suppose I'd better not. I ought to go at once to my mother-in-law. Owen's just been telling her, she said. Ah. Daryl hazarded a smile. That accounts for my having, on my way up, heard someone telephoning for Miss Painter. At the illusion they laughed together, vaguely, and Anna moved toward the door. He held it open for her, and followed her out. Six. He left her at the door of Madame de Chantel's sitting room, and plunged out alone into the rain. The wind flung about the stripped treetops of the avenue, and dashed the stinging streams into his face. He walked to the gate, and then turned into the high road, and strode along in the open, buffeted by slanting gusts. The evenly ridged fields were a blurred waste of mud, and the russet coverts which he and Owen had shot through the day before shivered desolately against a driving sky. Daryl walked on and on, indifferent to the direction he was taking. His thoughts were tossing like the treetops. Anna's announcement had not come to him as a complete surprise. That morning, as he strolled back to the house with Owen Leith and Miss Viner, he had had a momentary intuition of the truth. But it had been no more than an intuition, the merest faint cloud puff of surmise, and now it was an attested fact, darkening over the whole sky. In respect of his own attitude, he saw at once that the discovery made no appreciable change. If he had been bound to silence before, he was no less bound to it now. The only difference lay in the fact that what he had just learned had rendered his bondage more intolerable. Hitherto he had felt for Sophie Viner's defenseless state a sympathy profoundly tinged with compunction. But now he was half conscious of an obscure indignation against her. Superior as he had fancied himself to ready-made judgments, he was aware of cherishing the common doubt as to the disinterestedness of the woman who tries to rise above her past. No wonder she had been sick with fear on meeting him. It was in his power to do her more harm than he had dreamed. Assuredly he did not want to harm her, but he did desperately want to prevent her marrying Owen Leith. He tried to get away from the feeling, to isolate and exteriorize it sufficiently, to see what motives it was made of, but it remained a mere blind motion of his blood, the instinctive recoil from the thing that no amount of arguing can make straight. His tramp, prolonged as it was, carried him no nearer to enlightenment, and after trudging through two or three sallow mud-stained villages he turned about and wearily made his way back to Giver. As he walked up the black avenue, making for the lights that twinkled through its pitching branches, he had a sudden realization of his utter helplessness. He might think and combine as he would, but there was nothing, absolutely nothing, that he could do. He dropped his wet coat in the vestibule and began to mount the stairs to his room. But on the landing he was overtaken by a sober-faced maid who, in tones discreetly lowered, begged him to be so kind as to step, for a moment, into the Marquise's sitting room. Somewhat disconcerted by the summons, he followed its bearer to the door at which, a couple of hours earlier, he had taken leave of Mrs. Leith. It opened to admit him to a large lamp-lit room which he immediately perceived to be empty, and the fact gave him time to note, even through his disturbance of mind, the interesting degree to which Madame de Chantel's apartment dated and completed her. Its looped and corded curtains, its purple satin upholstery, the Sevres jardinieres, the rosewood fire screen, the little velvet tables etched with lace, and crowded with silver knick-knacks and simpering miniatures, reconstituted an almost perfect setting for the blonde beauty of the 60s. Darrow wondered that Fraser Leaf's filial respect should have prevailed over his aesthetic scruples to the extent of permitting such an anachronism among the 18th century graces of Giver. But a moment's reflection made it clear that, to its late owner, the attitude would have seemed exactly in the traditions of the place. Madame de Chantel's emergence from an inner room snatched Darrow from these irrelevant musings. She was already beaded and bugled for the evening, and, save for a slight pinkness of the eyelids, her elaborate appearance revealed no mark of agitation. But Darrow noticed that, in recognition of the solemnity of the occasion, she pinched a lace handkerchief between her thumb and forefinger. She plunged at once into the center of the difficulty, appealing to him, in the name of all the Everards, to descend there with her to the rescue of her darling. She wasn't, she was sure, addressing herself in vain to one whose person, whose tradition so brilliantly declared his indebtedness to the principles she besought him to defend. Her own reception of Darrow, the confidence she had at once accorded him, must have shown him that as he had instinctively felt their unanimity of sentiment on these fundamental questions. As he had in fact recognized in him the one person whom, without pain to her maternal piety, she could welcome as her son's successor. And it was almost as to Owen's father that she now appealed to Darrow to aid in rescuing the wretched boy. Don't think, please, that I'm casting the least reflection on Anna, or showing any want of sympathy for her, when I say that I consider her partly responsible for what's happened. Anna's modern, I believe that's what it's called, when you read unsettling books and admire hideous pictures. Indeed, Madame de Chantel continued, leaning confidentially forward, I myself have always more or less lived in that atmosphere. My son, you know, was very revolutionary. Only he didn't, of course, apply his ideas. They were purely intellectual. That's what dear Anna has always failed to understand. And I'm afraid she's created the same kind of confusion in Owen's mind, led him to mix up things you read about with things you do. You know, of course, that she sides with him in this wretched business? Developing at length upon this theme, she finally narrowed down to the point of Darrow's intervention. My grandson, Mr. Darrow, calls me illogical and uncharitable, because my feelings toward Miss Viner have changed since I've heard this news. Well, you've known her, it appears, for some years. Anna tells me you used to see her, when she was a companion, or secretary or something, to a dreadfully vulgar Mrs. Mert. And I ask you as a friend, I ask you as one of us, to tell me, if you think a girl who has had to knock about the world in that kind of position, and at the orders of all kinds of people, is fitted to be Owen's wife. I'm not implying anything against her. I liked the girl, Mr. Darrow. But what's that got to do with it? I don't want her to marry my grandson. If I'd been looking for a wife for Owen, I shouldn't have applied to the Farlows to find me one. That's what Anna won't understand, and what you must help me to make her see. Darrow, to this appeal, could oppose only the repeated assurance of his inability to interfere. He tried to make Madame de Chantel see that the very position he hoped to take in the household made his intervention the more hazardous. He brought up the usual arguments, and sounded the expected note of sympathy, but Madame de Chantel's alarm had dispelled her habitual imprecision, and, though as he had not many reasons to advance, her argument clung to its point like a frightened sharp-clawed animal. Well, then, she summed up, in response to his repeated assertions, that he saw no way of helping her, you can, at least, even if you won't say a word to the others, tell me frankly and fairly and quite between ourselves your personal opinion of Miss Viner, since you've known her so much longer than we have. He protested that, if he had known her longer, he had known her much less well, and that he had already, on this point, convinced Anna of his inability to pronounce an opinion. Madame de Chantel drew a deep sigh of intelligence. Why, your opinion of Mrs. Murd is enough. I don't suppose you pretend to conceal that? And heaven knows what other unspeakable people she's been mixed up with. The only friends she can produce are called Oak. Don't try to. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.